Welcome to Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. Each week, we dissect the news with experienced journalists from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Filling in for me as host this week is Chris Sapone. I'll hand you over to him. Thanks, Chris.
Last week, Prime Minister Scott Morrison gave an impassioned speech to the Queensland Resources Council.
Together with the Attorney General, Christian Porter, we are working to identify serious mechanisms that can successfully outlaw these indulgent and selfish practices that threaten the livelihoods of fellow Australians, especially in our rural and regional areas. Now, we will take our time to get this right. We will do the homework, and we're doing that right now. But we must protect our economy from this great threat.
He vowed to draft new laws banning protesters from boycotting companies. Civil liberty groups warned that the measures might attack free speech and undermine every Australian's right to protest. The changes were also called legally questionable and morally dubious. The significance of where the Prime Minister spoke from, in resource-rich Queensland, was lost on nobody. But who would benefit from these proposed changes? Is protest itself under attack? Or has it become the latest political football in the culture war unfolding online? I'm Chris Sapone, filling in for Tori Maguire. Joining us on this week's panel from the Sydney Morning Herald is senior journalist Jacqueline Maley and senior writer Nick O'Malley. This week, will boycotts in Australia be banned, or is it a ploy to shore up support in a state that delivered the last election to the government? Jackie, Nick, welcome. Let's start at the beginning. What happened last Friday? What was the PM doing at the Queensland Resources Council? Nick.
He was attending a meeting at the Minerals Council of Queensland. So he was in the very epicentre of coal country, I suppose you'd say. And he was giving a speech in which he described climate protesters as anarchists. And in it, he proposed pursuing methods by which the federal government might find a legal way in which they could prevent climate activists from using what are called secondary boycotts to try and force industry involved in resource extraction from burning more coal.
He used the opportunity to sort of rail against two separate things. So first of all, the sort of really vocal, visible climate activists, which he did say that some of them were anarchists or had anarchic sort of elements. And I suppose he was talking about, you know, the really visible and sort of confrontations with police that have been going on, for example, in the streets of Melbourne between climate protesters and police, which have been disruptive to traffic and so forth. And then he raised this other issue of secondary boycotts, which is sort of a more complex issue where an environmental group or a consumer lobby group or anyone really can lobby a business that does business itself with a target. So a coal company, a mining company, a bank, for example, that invests in a mining company, or a bank that might provide services to a mining company, or indeed a small business. So, you know, the small business down the road sending, sandwiches to the workers on site at a mining company. It seems he was sort of mostly talking about banks in particular, who are mostly the target of these sort of big consumer campaigns or activist campaigns. But it's unclear, and that's one of the sort of interesting political elements to this. I think he held up this very public enemy, and he created or presented this problem to the electorate without actually, I would say, making a case that such a problem exists.
I think to that end, there were two audiences in mind. One was the Minerals Council, which is the lobby group for the extractive industries. One more broadly was the electorate, in particular the Queensland electorate. And in that, you can read the politics a little bit more clearly, because in the speech he said, Australian industry has a right to go about its business without being bothered by these anarchists, which is obviously true. But then he said, particularly the coal industry, and he said, particularly in Queensland. Now, that's instructive over the politics, because the Labor Party, according to a lot of analysis, lost the election in Queensland over coal, over its support for the environment over coal. In that, Morrison sees the wedge. He sees that the Labor Party will be punished in inner city electorates and other electorates around Melbourne and Sydney if it supports the coal industry, and it cannot win Queensland if it's seen to be antagonistic towards the coal industry. So really, Morrison sees he's got Labor on the ground with his heel on its neck, and he's decided to push it in. The problem is, though, what he's suggesting runs far deeper than the next election cycle. I think he's trying to conflate those two things that Jackie was just mentioning. The people banging the drums in front of the meeting who are annoying some drivers, and a far larger movement around the world where very sophisticated investors are divesting from coal. And he can't challenge that legally in Australia. It's a movement that's happening around the world. I think in 2013, there were no people who were overtly divesting from coal for reasons of climate. And figures I saw today suggest that $8 billion a year is being divested from coal. There's a couple of reasons for this. One is the environmental concerns, but the other is that coal is a contracting industry for technological reasons as well. There are a lot of Australia's customers for thermal coal are backing away from coal. And so while there's still a heap of money to be made mining it and selling it, because it's a contracting industry, investors are more reticent to pump money into it. And so on the one hand, he's trying to defend the industry, but on the other hand, I think it's political posturing and signalling here.
So is this almost a topic that he would bring up in a campaign mode, even though there's no campaign that's going on?
There's a permanent campaign going on now. I think politics is now a lot more aggressive than it used to be, and he's in a permanent campaign mode.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the protesters themselves. Are we seeing new tactics in the way that people are speaking about the climate, and are they being more sort of confrontational? And is this having an effect on the political scene in Australia in general?
I know you're not endorsing that idea, Chris, but that's such a ridiculous idea to me. It's such a ridiculous assertion when you look at the history of protest, not just in our country, but around the world. Look at the great anti-Vietnam protests of the 70s, the civil rights campaigns that were run in the United States in the 1960s, even some of the more strident women's marches that have gone on around the world, particularly in the 70s. I mean, insurrection, confrontational protesting is not something new. And most of the people who are taking to the streets to protest on climate issues are not doing anything violent or non-lawful. But, you know, there is a small selection of people who are, and particularly the Extinction Rebellion people, who I believe their sort of whole philosophy of protest actually involves disrupting daily life and doing things that grab people's attention in that way. And so, you know, you can say that it's unfortunate because they're giving all protesters a bad name. You could condemn them, indeed, for disrupting the lives of ordinary people, but you can't say it's new, and you can't say it's anything worse than what we've seen before.
But it's coming against this backdrop we're seeing of increasing sort of political paralysis in a lot of open democracies, open liberal democracies like Australia and other countries in the Anglosphere. Are protesters themselves just taking matters into their own hands because they can see that they're not getting the political traction within the halls of power? Meanwhile, the industry is moving on, as Nick pointed out, that people are moving out of fossil fuels and into new renewables.
Absolutely. And in that sense, you could sort of look at the Morrison speech as a display of potency in an area where he really must know that he doesn't have all the power and all the control that he might want. Because as you say, that we have had sort of 10 years of paralysis in climate and energy policy on both sides of politics, and both major parties should bear responsibility for that. And in the meantime, civil society combined with the economy combined with business have decided to sort of take matters into their own hands, and they're moving around the political process in ways which are outside the realm of the political process. And what Nick's talking about is absolutely true. I mean, capital investment is moving away from coal-fired power and coal interests, not only for reasons of activism and so-called impact investment, which is a really hot thing right now, but for pragmatic reasons. The CBA has announced to its shareholders that it will move out of coal-fired power and thermal coal investments by 2030. The ASIC Commissioner has told Parliament that it's now very commonplace and indeed expected for company directors and CEOs to warn their investors, their shareholders, of climate change-based risks to the products and services that those companies provide. It's their duty to do so, and it's just unremarked upon now within business. So those things are happening, and as you say, people are taking to the streets, and children are taking this to the streets because they feel so frustrated by the politics of it. Those two things, I think, are actually quite beautiful and, dare I say it, efficient expressions of civil society and how it can move around the political process where the political process isn't serving them.
But this is something that we're seeing in capital cities, in the centers of cities. How are the images being viewed and the rhetoric being viewed outside of those areas? So when you go to rural Australia or you go to communities that have seen their economy sort of slump for multi-decades, how do they see this sort of activity?
There's fairly good evidence that some of the climate protests during the last election were not helpful, at least to Labor, or to those who opposed coal mines. The coal convoy, whatever it was called, appeared to backfire because it wasn't received well in those electorates that you're talking about. But the other thing to point out is that one of the reasons why people are banging drums on the street is because the lobbyists and the coal industry is inside at the boardroom table with the politicians. So for Morrison to be suggesting that people should not be allowed to protest out the front and everyone has the right to freedom of expression and should be able to go about their business unhindered is a little bit preposterous given that lobbyists are at the table with him. The other thing I'd say is that there is no more potent example of freedom of expression than a company choosing not to do business with coal because it's seeking to protect its reputation. That's not only an expression of freedom of expression, but the free market itself at work. And that's something that Morrison and some of his allies are at the moment railing against. And it's a deep inconsistency in this position, I think.
But in terms of your question, Chris, about how this is sort of received or perceived in regional and rural Australia in particular, outside the major cities, I mean, I guess it's difficult for a start for us to say because we're thoroughly urban creatures here at the Sydney Morning Herald, or quite urban creatures. But I do think it's an important one, and Morrison is very good at appealing to those non-urban Australians, and Queensland was obviously pivotal for him in the election. Queensland is a very pro-coal state, they're a very pro-mining state, and they do have, you know, I mean, I'm generalising here, but a lot of Queensland voters would have an instinctual kind of suspicion of the urban-based elites, as they're called, and the sort of the moral pretensions of those elites around climate change and stuff. And it's pretty easy to make an on-paper argument for why we should be moving jobs out of coal and, you know, into renewable energy or whatever. But if you're sitting in a coal mining community or a community that's prosperous because of the coal mining industry, you might think very differently. And why would you trade away your job now and the livelihood of your family and your children's security and all of that for something which doesn't exist yet and for a benefit that is notional at best and is not necessarily, that benefit's not necessarily going to accrue sort of directly to you and your family. So I think, you know, Morrison's onto something and he does sort of sympathise with those people. And he's making this argument also at a time when we are seeing a sort of contraction of the economy that's hitting regional and rural Australia much harder. It's compounded by this dreadful drought. Those communities are hurting and he's offering them sort of succour, I suppose. He's offering them some comfort, and certainly he's making them feel like they're listened to.
He's raised the prospect of some sort of action around secondary boycotts, but are we to look for him to actually do something, or is this a pledge that he can make and sort of derive the benefits from in the news cycle and then move on to other issues as they come up?
Well, he certainly did not make any firm commitments. I think the language that he used was that the government was working to identify mechanisms that can successfully outlaw these indulgent and selfish practices. So there is a piece of legislation, which is consumer and competition law, which it was put in place by a previous coalition government. I think it was the Fraser government, actually. And it was sort of directed at the unions. That's what this kind of legislation has always been directed at, secondary boycott legislation, to stop unions pressuring companies not to do business with the big company that they're having an industrial dispute with. And last year, the CFMEU was fined $1 million for contravening that legislation. But there are two important exemptions to it, and that's for people, for consumer groups and for environmental activist groups. So he might be like, well, we're just going to legislate to get rid of those exemptions or to get rid of the environmental activist exemption.
But in this climate, even advocating for that or even pushing for that, does that give Morrison the benefit enough? I mean, it's not so much the success of a particular policy outcome, but the impression of moving in that direction and the image of it. Is that actually more important these days?
I think he's made the calculation that at this stage in the political cycle, yeah, there is benefit in him signalling to his friends and his allies that he's got their back. An effective way of doing that in this new combative period of politics is to signal who your opponents are. And it doesn't come out of the blue, and it's not just this legislation. Earlier this year, the government also flagged introducing legislation to ban vegan terrorists, I think was their word, from farms. This is a broader project of this government to triangulate and divide the electorate in a way that it sees to its benefit. And that's not a new thing.
That was senior writer Nick O'Malley and senior journalist Jacqueline Maley from the Sydney Morning Herald. Very soon, we'll be discussing what these proposed changes could mean to protest laws in Australia.
Hi, I'm Michael Batchelard. I'm the investigations and foreign editor at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald have by far the country's biggest investigations teams, breaking stories about corruption, crime, and social and political issues. We also have foreign correspondents in Asia, China, Europe, and the US. Both are expensive, but crucial to providing news for and by Australians that help our readers interpret the world. And if people value that, we need people to subscribe so we can keep doing it. Subscribers allow us to dig deeper into the important stories that matter to our readers.
You're listening to Please Explain. I'm Chris Sapone, filling in for Tori Maguire. And my guests today are senior journalist Jackie Maley and senior writer Nick O'Malley, both from the Sydney Morning Herald. Jackie, let me ask you, what are the legal implications of these proposed changes?
Well, we don't know yet, in short, because the proposed changes don't have any shape or form, or we're even speculating about the legislation that Scott Morrison might make changes under. But generally, you know, the constitutional lawyers have already been out talking about how this might contravene a very well accepted and well established right that Australians have to, it's an implied right to freedom of speech, which has been read into our constitution. So in Australian law, we don't actually have rights in the proactive sense that Americans do, for example, because we don't have a Bill of Rights, but we have plenty of rights, of course. And the one right really that is well established because it's been read into our constitution by the High Court is this implied right to political communication or freedom of, it's been called a freedom of speech, although it's not that broad. Now, using your money to lobby a company or using your money to make a political statement is, I would say, very firmly within the remit of that implied right. So I would imagine, and again, it's really speculative, but I would imagine that any legal change that Morrison made to this would be very possibly subject to a constitutional challenge.
Now, looking over the past few years in English-speaking democracies, there's been this trend for right-leaning parties to champion free speech, but in some cases, using the concept of free speech is almost a Trojan horse for other sort of cultural issues and grievances that they have. What's interesting about what Morrison has proposed is it seems to actually go in the opposite direction. It's an actual curtailment of rights. Is that significant? Is that something that you've noticed as well, Nick?
I think it's a quirk of Australian politics. It's something I've long commented on, that we have this view of ourselves as being larrikins who thumb our nose at authority. And yet, whenever Australians are asked to side with a government telling them what to do, or a bunch of rabble-rousers or ratbags challenging that, Australians seem to fall down fairly often on the side of the government or the authority. So that's not perhaps that's surprising. If you listen to the language that Morrison used, he referred to the quiet Australians. He's been using the term ever since the election. That's probably a redux of the silent majority, but it also goes back to Menzies' idea of the forgotten Australians. It's always been part of the Liberal Party's culture and its personality, that it is to represent those people who just get on with their lives and they don't get out in the street, they don't make trouble, and they just want a handful of things looked after properly by a mature government. The problem is at the moment is that there are a lot of industries and interest groups that can get around individuals and speak directly to government. We referred to that earlier with the lobby groups. And this is where those two ideas clash. To have an Australian government opposing individuals or even individuals' companies' rights to behave as they see fit to on behalf of an industry appears to clash with that notion of the liberal identity. But perhaps it works more in Australia than it does in other countries. Obviously, in the United States, as Jackie was saying, with its First Amendment, there is this firmly entrenched idea that people have every right to political expression. And that doesn't exist in Australia's culture as strongly.
Is there a sense that people have been driven to this because there has been a breakdown in the mechanisms where the public voice on an issue can be heard within Parliament, and instead they've become captive to the industries and to the lobbyists?
I think that's certainly the case, but it's not just the individuals. Well, it's not just the individuals you see on the street banging drums. One in five shareholders in BHP want BHP to abandon its affiliation with organisations which do not support the Paris Climate Accord. That is code for saying one in five Australians want BHP to walk away from the Minerals Council of Australia. Morrison made this speech at the Minerals Council of Australia. The Minerals Council of Australia is made up of the extractive industries which back the coalition, particularly Queensland. So, yeah, there are actors in Australian politics at the moment which would benefit from this over others, and that is anti-democratic in my view.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the coalition's sort of support for freedom of speech issues, obviously the big freedom of speech issue that really blew up under Tony Abbott's government was the changes to the Racial Discrimination Act. And Tony Abbott, well, he made a personal pledge to Andrew Bolt before he was elected to power that he would change those provisions, which outlawed sort of hate speech, I suppose. And he tried to do that. He expended a lot of political capital over doing that. And then he eventually abandoned that on the back of, you know, a very strong sort of grassroots campaign, and also a campaign sort of led by the Race Discrimination Commissioner at the time to stop that happening. And Scott Morrison, interestingly, during that debate, was not really one of the people who was front and centre. He's not like a freedom warrior. He's not like one of the sort of more libertarian members of the coalition by any stretch. And also, he is a man of faith, I think, you know, and knows very well the value of multicultural voters to the coalition. So he was sort of smarter, I think, in a sense, on that debate. So it's not like he looks like a personal hypocrite for sort of championing free speech over 18C and now abandoning it because he doesn't like people lobbying coal interests. But at the same time, overall in the coalition, the politics of this, you know, if they ever actually get serious about it in terms of trying to legislate for it, I think that's when you'll see the backbench pipe up and the sort of more libertarian elements within the coalition worrying that this is a step too far.
Given the political polarization that we're seeing in politics across democracies, where are the people in this debate that acknowledge that, yes, fossil fuels, they're on their way out, essentially, but at the same time, they do provide an enormous boost to this economy? And to use fossil fuels, which all of us do, it's a natural sort of thing to do as of 2019. So there's the people that are involved in the fossil fuels industry aren't necessarily bad guys, and the protesters are not necessarily all angels, but there is this middle ground. Does anybody advocate for that, or are they just lost in the noise and the furor that we see online?
Well, I think the Labor Party is, that's the tightrope it is attempting to walk. And what Anthony Albanese, as he sort of rebrands or, you know, takes the Labor Party to the next election, that's his challenge to do that. And he's been trying very hard to sort of talk to the coal industry, or to talk to people, workers, I suppose, who are affected or who are employed by the coal industry, and say, like, we don't think you're the enemy. We understand that you need your jobs. We understand that coal is going to be a major part of the Australian economy going forward. We don't deny that. But, you know, we need to, you know, facilitate other industries. And, well, you know, he hasn't said anything about emissions targets yet. It's going to be really interesting to see how, if the Labor Party can pull that off, because I've made this point before in my columns that there is this enormous groundswell of support for climate action. And so many people within the community who feel worried about climate change, but Labor has just proved hopeless at harnessing that in an electoral sense. They managed it in 2007. Kevin Rudd really was brought to power on the back of a lot of climate pledges, and John Howard was so threatened by it that he sort of signed on to an emissions trading scheme in the election campaign in 2007. But then, of course, Kevin Rudd squibbed it, the Labor Party squibbed it, the electorate's never forgotten them for it. So there is this enormous groundswell. Labor has been unable to harness it politically because of all the losers, and because, you know, we saw Bill Shorten in the last election campaign not being up front and in fact refusing to answer questions about how much emissions reductions targets that Labor was holding forth would actually affect people, and how much it would put up energy prices, and how many people would go out of business, or how many people would lose their jobs over it. I mean, any politician who who seeks to capitalise on climate change action also needs to be upfront about the costs of that action. And no politician has really been able to do that yet.
I think it's interesting that they have in other countries. They have in countries where industry, unions and government work together more effectively to solve problems. Germany's completely decommissioning its entire coal industry. But it's taken them 40 years, 30 years to do so, of constant planning, negotiation and moving forward. And the Australian polity's kind of fallen apart on that. But you did see Albo just last week explicitly talking about what Jacqueline was just talking about, trying to link harnessing new technologies and moving away from the coal industry to jobs, to a discussion about jobs and job creation, rather than to a discussion about climate change. But this is the constant problem, not just with the coal industry, but with any discussion of climate change. You're talking about very real immediate losers against hypothetical future winners. And Australia just hasn't had the political will and leadership recently to harness those two things. But the time's coming, because industry, as I keep saying, well, industry and finance is moving away from coal.
So this issue, as it unfolds, is actually becoming more of a culture war. Is that right?
Certainly. And Morrison's speech at the Minerals Council, apart from being, you know, overtly political, it was also overtly cultural. The language he used was cultural. The way he described environmentalists as anarchists and as, you know, the language that his front bench, the coalition's front bench, has been using for some time to describe anyone who challenges the coal industry has been entirely cultural.
I mean, it's worth noting, too, that as these protests have gained more attention in Australia, there's been a wave of new protests around the world in countries where the ideas of democratic participation had really been on the decline. So we've seen in Chile, in Iraq, in Lebanon, these are far-flung places, but there is this sense that we're in this season of protest globally. Do you see this as connected to that?
In that politics is failing some people, it's loosely connected. I think in those countries, though, obviously people are facing far more real issues in their lives, real and damaging and threatening issues in their lives. Also in all of those places, populations are far younger. Australia's got kind of a moderate older population. But I do think they're broadly connected. I think there is dissatisfaction with political systems around the world, and that's being expressed in many ways, but also on the street.
Jackie?
Yeah, it's interesting because, as you say, there is this global renaissance of protesting in very colourful and interesting ways, and there's a lot of passion and huge numbers. I mean, you know, central London, when it had its most recent Extinction Rebellion shut down, like the whole of the inner city was sort of like shut down in London. I mean, it's very spectacular to sort of see photographed. But it's happening at the same time that we're seeing reported a malaise in politics or political engagement more generally across Western democracies. And this has been noted, and, you know, there's a lot of sound research to back it up in Australia as well as overseas, that people, you know, are more disaffected with the political process than ever. They have more contempt for politicians. They're less engaged. People are becoming sort of disillusioned and disaffected with the political process and with their politicians. So I don't know, maybe actually those things aren't in conflict with each other. Maybe they go hand in hand. But it seems that, you know, certainly the Greta Thunbergs of the world and all who follow her have certainly given up on politicians in a way. And so they're protesting as people always have and probably always will. They're showing their disaffection and dissatisfaction in visible, vocal ways that will be picked up by media and seen by people around the world.
Well, Jacqueline Maley, Nick O'Malley, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks to our Please Explain guests this week, Jackie Maley and Nick O'Malley. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Lee Samoglu and David Escort. Technical assistance by David McMillan and Cormac Lally. Amelia McGuire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Chris Sapone. Thanks for listening.